Tonight I have the pleasure in introducing to you Mr. Jeff Muirden, who most of you have heard before. He's Secretary of the Australian Civil Liberties Union, and tonight he'll be speaking on the Mabo issue, which is a very controversial issue over last year and probably going into this year, I'd say. So without any further ado, I'd like you to put your hands together for Mr. Jeff Muirden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. You'll find on the seats I've left some photocopies of material. Please feel free to study that and take it away with you. For those who are listening to the tape, that will be this will be mentioned in the talk, the references that I've handed out. Ladies and gentlemen, the world is mad and it's getting madder. And this is not a new discovery, it's been known for centuries. The famous historian Edward Gibbon commented that history is indeed little more than the register of the crimes, follies and misfortunes of mankind. The Mabo madness is a local example of insanity, but behind this apparent insanity is a purpose. The promotion of political control of the Aborigines behind a mask of high-sounding rhetoric. It was originally promoted, as Geoff McDonald makes clear in Red Over Black, by communists trying to create a separate Aboriginal nation within Australia and then trying to get control of that Aboriginal nation by Marxist interests. Since then, the Soviet Union has fallen, and some people think that there's now no danger from communism, but it's important not to bury communism until it's dead. Communism has survived in countries such as Libya, China, Eastern Europe, etc., and is still influencing millions of people around the world, although many local communists in Australia have joined the Greenie movement, which helped accept the Mabo law. The Greenies, by the way, have been compared to a watermelon, green on the outside and red on the inside. Well, this is the background to the mighty rush in which Prime Minister Keating determined to produce a Mabo legislation before Christmas 1993. If you read the Herald Sun, the Age, the Australian on those dates, you would have realised that he was in a great hurry to rush through that legislation. He showed great determination to bring what he called justice for the Aboriginal people. Warning voices were raised by some, including the rebel Labor MP for Kalgoorlie, Graham Campbell, but he was forced to vote according to the party line or be dismissed. In the end, the Mabo Bill was passed with the support of the West Australian Greens and the Democrats on 21st December 1993, the major dissenting voice perhaps being that of Dr. Hewson, who declared that the Native Title Bill was an unprincipled piece of legislation which has lost sight of what Australia is all about, a united democratic country in which all our people are equal before the law, as reported in the Australian, December 22, 1993. This was a voice of sanity among the Mabo madness. He implied the fact that the bill created special privileges for Aborigines, thus constituting racial discrimination against the majority of whites. Now, since Paul Keating showed so much energy in promoting the Native Title Bill in the interest of supposed justice to Aborigines, why doesn't he show similar energy or even greater energy in moving to remedy a greater evil, which is the way in which racial injustice has been done against the Anglo-Saxon and Celtic majority, whose tradition of democratic rule has been hijacked by party lines and issues accompanied in party rooms? In other words, why didn't Mr. Keating say to his ministers, "Hey, you recalcitrant scumbags, don't you realise that the rights and democratic structure of the Anglo-Saxon and Celtic majority have been violated, which infringes the Racial Discrimination Act and is therefore illegal, and that would also infringe the Racial Vilification Act if it comes in, and may come in this year. And we shall now move heaven and earth to rectify this situation with sittings far into the night to remedy this racial discrimination." And so saying, Mr. Paul Keating would then move towards implementing CIR, cancelling the international treaties and conventions with the UN because they undermine Australian sovereignty, and move against the British system of democratic government and constitutional rule. Now, that is a flight of fantasy. Obviously, it's not going to happen. But actually, that's a kind of a sick joke in itself, because it underlines the fact that we're dealing with a kind of madness here, a kind of madness that is politically correct. Part of the insanity is shown in the way in which it's PC to act on behalf of a racial minority, the Aborigines, and in so doing, act against the racial majority of non-Aborigines. And by some trick of reasoning, this is not seen as racial discrimination. Tim Hewitt points out in this book, Who Made the Mabo Mess, the main blame for inflating a land claim in the Murray Islands based on land about half the size of Tullamarine Airport, and that's about the same size as the island of Mur in the Murray Islands, in what is potentially the whole of Australia must rest on Paul Keating. Les Carlyon, writing in Business Review Weekly, said, "The madness of Mabo, the cargo cult of the great white father in Canberra." Now, two key sources for studying the background of the Mabo madness, which I recommend people to read, are Jeff McDonald's Red Over Black, Peter R. English's Land Rights and Birthrights, and two important tapes are Eric Butler's Is There a Hidden Agenda Behind Politics? And The Mabo Decision by Dr. David Mitchell. They're both available for MEA tapes. Now, Jeff McDonald's book in particular documents that the aim of the Mabo madness is not land rights for Aborigines, since the views of full-blooded Aborigines and tribal elders are not being considered, but rather the interest of half-blood Aborigines and white activists placed in the Department of Aboriginal Affairs and ATSIC, that is, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders Commission, who've pursued a Marxist dialectic to gain power over Aborigines all over Australia. As part of their divide-and-rule tactics, they also favour multiculturalism, which leads to a fragmented culture, increasing unemployment and economic decline. Part of their tactics are such stunts as the sacred rights hoax. Cynics have pointed out that the fastest way to find a sacred site is to look for a mining place to set up. Then sacred sites arise immediately in that very spot. Now, Peter B. English points that sacred sites' locations could not be revealed to outsiders on pain of death. They were revealed to full-blooded Aborigines, tribal elders. They were not to reveal the location of sacred sites, otherwise they risked execution. So where do they get their information from? The half-bloods, which form the political activists, would have no chance of being initiated into these secrets, and they would also be under a death threat if they did, if by some chance they were told. And lastly, even if these were genuine sacred sites, monetary payments would never be proper compensation for Aborigines. This is but one stunt used to exploit the so-called land rights issue for financial gain. Another example has been provided by an article in the Sunday Herald Sun, January 2nd, 1994, headed "Quit, Falls, Follow Audit." That's one of the photocopies that I've given you there. On January 2nd, 1994, which mentions that two of the most prominent activists, Galloway Yunupingu, who was chairman of the Northern, Northern Land Council, and Mick Dodson, its director until 1993, and also the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, personally benefited from breach of rules, whereby Yunupingu's credit card bills were paid from government funds and he has not repaid cash advances of up to $23,000, while Dodson gave himself a fringe benefit deal, as a result of which he's called on to resign. I haven't heard yet whether he has actually resigned, but he was called on to resign at that date. It's just another instance of the lack of accountability of Aboriginal organisations, and the restoration of sanity to the Mabo madness would be to heed the call for independent audits of land councils and Aboriginal legal services. But the main aspects of the Mabo madness I want to mention is the use of racism to describe criticism of Aboriginal land right policies, and the build-up of a massive guilt industry whereby all present-day whites have a huge collective guilt for all evils visited upon Aborigines to the present day. This is presented in very one-sided terms as an alleged genocide attempt against Aborigines, which could only be atoned for by whites paying indemnity to Aborigines and handing back slabs of Australia to them. And the claims by activists go beyond that. Charles Perkins declared on ABC Radio that the whole of Australia is Aboriginal land. And in 1993 at a conference, Charles Perkins suggested there should be an Aboriginal provisional government to be funded by an annual compensation bill of $1 billion every year, that's each year, paid by the Australian government out of the hides of taxpayers. That would presumably be in addition to other monies spent on Aborigines, which total about $2 billion already. Much of these extravagant claims are fuelled by the guilt industry, which got through to the judges that determined the Mabo High Court decision. Justices Dean and Gaudron said that, I quote here, "The acts and events by which that dispossession in legal theory was carried into practical effect constitute the darkest aspect of the history of this nation," unquote. And a further quote, "The nation as a whole must remain diminished unless and until there is an acknowledgement of and retreat from these past injustices," unquote. So the High Court judges swallowed the guilt industry line, hook, line and sinker. And in the end, their decision was a political and not a legal one. That's a political statement that they've made. It's not a legal one. Justice Brennan, in particular, was clearly in bed with internationalists in his determination that he said the common law had to go along with international law and expectations. He claimed that the expectations of the international community accord with the contemporary values of the Australian people, although he failed to show this to be true. This is a political announcement, not a legal one. But anyone who wants more information on the legal aspects of it could read Mabo and Political Policy Making by the High Court by Gabriel Moens, Associate Professor of Law, University of Queensland, in Mabo, a Judicial Revolution. To reiterate, much of this determination rests on the madness of the guilt industry in which whites have to hide their heads in shame for the actions of their forebears. Now, this is madness, ladies and gentlemen, for two reasons. Firstly, it's unjust to insist that present-day whites have to be guilty for any injustices committed before they are even born. Secondly, even if this collective guilt industry is to be accepted, then the Aborigines need to cast a very large moat out of their own eye, because there's archaeological and historical evidence that present-day Aborigines exterminated the races living in Australia before them, those of Papuan origin, also known as Tasmanoids and Negritos. When the Dravidians invaded Australia from southern India and Ceylon, as it's now called Sri Lanka, the Papuans were massacred, and those women who survived were married into the invading tribes. A mass of information is being suppressed to prevent the public knowing that present-day Aborigines were invaders who massacred the original Australians. Some of the evidence comes from books such as Cape York, The Savage Frontier by Rodney Liddell, The Aborigines of Australia by J.W. Bleakley, A Despised Race by F.R. Gribble and others. Read those for more details. Now, Rex Gilroy, director of the Pre-Aboriginal Research Centre, P.O. Box 202, Katoomba, New South Wales 2780, mentions archaeological evidence and also Aboriginal traditions that the Aborigines killed off a former white-skinned race and a race of giants, just as the Maoris killed off the race occupying New Zealand when they landed there, which means, of course, that the Maoris are also guilty of genocide as well. The Aborigines wiped out the Tasmanian type of Aborigines, pushing them across to Tasmania. They wiped them off the mainland. So if whites have to feel guilty for the accusation of attempted genocide, then by the same token, present-day Aborigines should also feel guilty about their genocide of pre-Davidians. It will be an interesting sight to see Aborigines all over Australia crying their eyes out over their genocide of pre-Dravidians and about the way in which Aborigine raids killed white settlers and their animals. I haven't seen much evidence of it yet. If in spite of all this madness the Aborigines get compensation, I think the whites should counterclaim for all improvements made since settlement. Roads, bridges, medical services, food, etc., which should be at least equal to any Aboriginal claims for compensation. So if they hit us for $3 billion, we counterclaim for $3 billion in exchange. Fair exchange, I think. The use of one-side accusation against whites has led to stupid extremes of political correctness, such as the denunciation of Alan Cullen, Executive Director of the Australian Bankers Association, who used the term ABO on radio and was denounced for racism. He didn't even criticise them, but he just used the term ABO, and that made him a racist. Whereas, of course, many Australians use this term merely as an abbreviation. Henry Bosch was sacked last year, that's 1993, for calling Aborigines a Stone Age people, which at the time of settlement they were. Since you're only making a factual statement, it's difficult to see how that's racist. But that's part of the Mabo madness. The Mabo madness says that while it's never politically correct for whites to use any term that might be called racist, it's quite okay for blacks to be as racist as they please against whites. One of the biggest accusations is that the whites killed off all the Aborigines in Tasmania. Actually, I've left some information on your seats there to the effect that there are some half-castes still in Tasmania at the present time. But effectively, it could be said that the Tasmanian full-blood Aborigine is now extinct. But are the whites totally to blame? Now, doubt has been cast on this by an article written by Patricia Coburn entitled Who Really Killed Tasmanian Aborigines? In the Bulletin, February the 23rd, 1982, pages 32 to 34. Patricia Coburn suggests that the warlike Tasmanian tribes were in the process of dying out and they would have eventually vanished even without the whites because of factors such as their eating habits, killings by rival tribes, coldness at night with lack of clothing and venereal diseases before the white men came. All those are factors in explaining their demise. Coburn concludes that the killer that stalked the Tasmanian Aboriginal tribe was the traditions and customs of the race. Its face was not white. Part of the Mabo madness is to assume that there was an Aboriginal nation when the whites landed. In fact, there were scattered Aboriginal tribes. I think there were about 500 separate tribes. not one unified nation had covered the continent. When we hear about massacres by whites against Aborigines, let's not forget the warlike nature of the Tasmanian Aborigines and their massacres of whites. The Tasmanian Aborigines, the Fullbloods, were very warlike people. They made attacks upon the whites, and that of course occasioned a backlash by the whites, who were racist enough to object to being killed. As well, on the mainland, studies such as Geoffrey Blaney's Triumph of the Nomads do not show a cultural Eden. On the contrary, there were bands of rival tribes that attacked each other. The number of Aborigines were depleted by raids for diseases, for which herbal treatments were often inadequate, by harsh climates, and which could lead to starvation on walkabout. Barbarous tribal customs, such as slashing the body with stones, could lead to infection, injury and death. If more babies were born than could be fed, they were killed and old people left to die. Also, there's nothing very idyllic about the Aboriginal treatment of women. The customs of the Arunta, for example, was to treat women as chattels. Girls were promised to their husbands before they were born. If the girls didn't meet the husband's satisfaction, she could be given away to a relative. Before marriage, a woman was deflowered with a stone axe, then given to relatives and friends to share her sexual favours before passing her back to her husband. I feel sure that Germaine Greer would not approve. While no doubt it's true that Aborigines were harshly treated by whites, and I'm not denying that there were occasions when the whites did attack Aborigines and acted unjustly, yet this is not a universal rule. At the earliest permanent settlement in Portland, Victoria, founded by Edward Henty in 1834, the Henty family was on good terms with the blacks. In the book Portland Barefoot Days, Richard Henty makes some comments that would now make him politically correct. For example, he accuses the whites of introducing the blacks to alcohol, which ruined their health as a nation. Similar comments have been made up to the present day. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I have a problem with this. If the whites had grabbed hold of the natives and physically poured Foster's Lager and Johnny Walker whiskey down their throats while they're kicking and struggling and trying to escape, then the whites would be directly to blame for Aborigine drunkenness. But it's a maxim in psychology that people are responsible for individually solving their own illnesses. Therapists agree that the individual responsibility of transforming some kind of neurosis or disease, including alcoholism, ultimately rests on the individual. So the Aborigines must themselves assume some responsibility for their own drunkenness without passing all the blame onto whites, which they often do. Richard Henty mentions the drunkenness problem, but he also mentions some of the Aborigine talents, and these we should be aware of as well. He mentions, for example, their knowledge of woodcraft, the quick unerring eye, the sharpness at detecting the slightest indication of signs, tracks, sounds, etc., in which the European could not approach him, while on the other hand is to acquire the ordinary mechanical knowledge of the white teacher. In their natural habitat, savages, of course, and that's what he says, now they get him for racism for saying that. And then he adds that they possessed quick intelligence and aptitude no one who knew them could deny, and moreover they were faithful to white treatment. In terms of skill in the bush, the Aborigines had no equal. This was a mistake that explorer Robert O'Hara Burke failed to learn. Burke believed the dignity of a white man to learn from the Aborigines how to survive in harsh territory, and he had what Manning Clark calls an attack of the sillies, driving away the Aborigines when they tried to help him. He died when he might have lived with help from the Aborigines. His action was extremely foolish because he failed to recognise the talent Aborigines have in handling the land, the bush, the difficulties of the wilderness. But to return to Richard Henty, he noticed that most of the Aborigines he knew died out. I'd almost call that a holocaust, except there's another mob has a copyright on that title, and no one else is allowed to suffer as much as they did, so I mustn't breach the copyright. The other mob also uses the idea of collective guilt, financial reparation, and hysterical rather than historical evidence. So we better not call it a holocaust. But when it comes to estimating the death toll among Aborigines, in the 18th century historian Geoffrey Blaney, in his book In a Land Half Won, Geoffrey Blaney claims that to reach an equally long death toll in the 19th century, one in every 600 Aborigines would have had to die during warfare in a typical year. Evidence I have gathered of Aboriginal fighting in traditional times suggests tentatively that such a death rate was not impossible. Even a death rate twice as heavy was possible. So in other words, Blaney is saying that the highest estimate of blacks killed by whites is 20,000. But Blaney estimates they killed that many or twice as many of their own kind in tribal warfare before contact with whites. In other words, they were trying to genocide some of their own people, some of their own Aboriginal tribes. some of their opponents. So tales of alleged white genocide are not only one-sided but ignore Aboriginal genocide of previous races and the warlike nature of Aborigines at the time of settlement, in which they killed off many of their fellow tribesmen. I'm grateful to Alan James for some of this information here. This sort of one-sided presentation is given by an Aboriginal, Bill Bird, writing in the magazine On Being, December 1993-94, called Reconciliation, where he starts out blaming the whites for all his troubles until he decides he has to forgive them because it's a Christian thing to do. Well, that's all well and good, but he fails to admit the evils committed against the whites and the Aboriginal genocide of previous races, so there's a little bit of self-righteousness in there. So the idea of the guilt industry used one-sidedly against the whites and the racist tag is part of the Mabo madness that needs discarding. Now, leaving that to one side, we come to consider the terms of the Mabo settlement. Eddie Mabo, who was a Melanesian, never expected when he made his claim for sovereignty of the Murray Islands or the island of Mur that it could be used as a basis for a claim covering the entire mainland. But the High Court, for political reasons and accepting the guilt industry and the racist tag, abolished the doctrine of terra nullius, whereby Australia ceased to be regarded as legally unoccupied. Now, I'd like to clarify that term terra nullius. More exactly, the term terra nullius has been misinterpreted as meaning that there were no people when Australia was settled. In fact, it more precisely means no use of the land or uncultivated land, because when Australia was settled, the Aborigines were a nomadic race. They were a hunter-gatherer race. They were not farmers. It was a practice of the British to make treaties with territories they occupied, but they couldn't make a treaty with the Aborigines because they were a nomadic race. They weren't part of a recognised government or part of a settled community. And I think this fact itself has not been emphasised enough. I think most people are not aware of it, actually. I don't think the High Court mentioned this or made much of it. Now, the High Court said native title was extinguished or destroyed if Aboriginals moved off their land or if it was used for non-traditional purposes. They also said native title was destroyed if any other title was legally granted, for example, freehold or leasehold, even though there was a question mark about mining. The Racial Discrimination Act 1975 was central to the debate and was retained because only legally granted land titles could extinguish native title. The Act requires all Australians be treated equally except in special cases. This meant Aboriginal native title holders were entitled to the same compensation as white land holders if the title of the land was taken away. So titles and leases granted after 1975 on land which would previously qualify for native title were illegal under the Act because no compensation was paid. Aboriginal groups can now gain native title by lodging a claim with a federal tribunal and trying to win their case. That's under the Native Title Act 1993, which was passed in December 1993 in federal parliament. Federal tribunals have been set up to judge claims. The address of the National Native Title Tribunal branch in Melbourne, if you want to check it, is at Level 2, 451 Little Bourke Street, Melbourne. Their phone number 282 8444, and they can supply details of any claims made. I phoned them today, that's 7th of February 1994, and I found that there have four cases have been considered for preliminary judgment. They have not been completely accepted because they're still subject to working out in detail. But if they're meet the proper legal requirements, four cases may come up soon. Now, since most Aborigines live in towns and cities, few have any basis to make claims under Mabo, which means that many Aborigines will not be able to make a claim at all. Ironically, some Aborigines have expressed concern that the claims may be made against them by other Aborigines. So it's not just something that affects whites, it can affect Aborigines who are afraid of claims being made by other Aborigines. Tim Fisher was right when he mentioned last year that government provisions for Aborigines were already generous, even pre-Mabo, especially in terms of the way in which half-bloods could apply for government handouts and join the gravy train. Under Mabo law, native title is not vested in individuals but in corporations. Native title will be of little commercial use to holders as it is impossible to sell it. Consequently, some Aboriginal organisations are becoming more business-like, forming into corporations. If you study what they're doing, you'll notice that they're now starting to hold more conferences in which they agree to form business corporations and study economics and become more organised in that way. What is the future for Mabo? Well, there was an interesting letter received It's in one of your handouts there. It's from The Age, Tuesday, 25th January 1994. It's headed Why WA Fights Native Title Law, and it's from Richard Court, MLA, Premier of Western Australia. Now, that's particularly important because West Australia is perhaps the state that's most affected by Mabo legislation. In fact, at one stage, 80% of Western Australia was claimed. 80%. But I'll read the letter from Richard Court in The Age. It says, "Your editorial of 18th January contains a great deal of fiction to suggest that our real aim in raising the issue of the over-centralisation of government in Canberra is to overturn the 1967 referendum transferring powers on Aboriginal affairs from the states to the federal government is false. We will continue to fight the federal native title legislation because, apart from being incredibly complex and unworkable in Western Australia, it assumes the federal government has the power to dictate to the states on a number of key land management issues. Western Australia will continue to fight the abuse of the external affairs power and the excessive use of tied financial grants to dictate to the state and how policies are to be implemented. The division of powers and responsibilities between the states and Canberra is now dramatically different than that agreed to in 1901. Our goal in Western Australia is to strengthen the Federation, which requires a reversal of this unhealthy trend. Canberra's national solutions to issues which are properly the province of the states are just centralism in disguise. Throughout the world, countries are moving away from centralist models. Democracy is about people being able to make decisions at a local community level where they know what is best for them. Yeah. By contrast, Canberra's remote, impersonal bureaucracy generates some outrageous policy prescriptions and directives. Our move is to restore the true spirit of the Federal Compact, as set down in the Constitution, is not just another state's rights rerun. We believe Australia will be damaged economically, socially and politically if the present centralist trend continues. Western Australia will not sit back and see this happen." Richard Court, Perth. A very important letter from one directly affected by Mabo legislation. And of course you'll notice a particular emphasis on centralist control and the denial of state rights. Because it's a power grab by Canberra and a denial of state rights and the rights of the states to set up their own tribunals and administer it without the big brother government coming in. Difficulties under Mabo legislation, as it was in December 1993, could exist in that exploration rights under current legislation suggest that mining companies will have to settle with Aboriginal occupants, get their permission to mine and pay compensation, and that will discourage mining of minerals. The Aborigines may even use the old sacred site stunt again. Now, this is just going to discourage mining, and in fact very few mines have been set up in the Northern Territory in the last 15 years because of this sort of thing going on. The haggling over compensation and stealing native land, the lawsuits, the squabbles, the expense are just too massive for many mining companies to be bothered with. And it hasn't been properly resolved under the terms of the legislation. Another consideration is that the radicals won't stop with the current deal. Many, such as Charles Perkins, want complete sovereignty, not just a land deal. Now, Mandawai Yunupingu, writing in the Herald Sun, and I refer this article here, Give Back Our Laws, that's in Herald Sun, January 25th, 1994, page 18, he insists that Aboriginal tribal law should be part of common law, fitting within the guidelines of international human rights conventions. Now, he's admitting here that tribal law can be barbarous, but he says it should be amended in terms of international law. He says here, tribal law has to fit within the guidelines of international human rights conventions, so traditional punishments that might today be considered barbaric would not be part of the common law. And he says the courts have to accept that Aboriginal tribal law has to be part of the common law. So he's making a power grab to the effect of tribal laws having equal status, possibly even greater status than the common law. He implies also, Mr. Yunupingu, that mining companies should have Aborigines on their board of management, presumably even if it means shoving off whites. Now, there's another thing that's been mentioned by Peter Reith, the Shadow Minister of State. He suggests a mechanism by which claims could be made to create a sovereign state. An organisation calling itself the Working Group on Indigenous People has created a draft text, the UN Declaration of Indigenous Rights. Now, Peter Reith says, if this draft is approved in 1994, it is likely it would be ratified by the federal Labor government. If it was ratified, as he seemed to think is very likely, it would enable an appeal to the UN Human Rights Commission, which could approve paragraph 29 in the draft, which expresses their supposed right to autonomy and sovereignty. So there could be a power grab and a claim for sovereignty in terms of that Working Group on Indigenous Peoples and the UN Declaration on Indigenous Rights. So perhaps a few letters to Canberra would not go amiss concerning the dangers of this particular legislation. Now, the US government was directly opposed to similar legislation in the United States because it clashed with national law. They were making the point that under a national law, all citizens basically are subject to that law, and you shouldn't have another sovereign state within that community, which I think is a very fair provision, and I think it's one that we should accept for Australia. The idea of establishing a kind of apartheid in Australia is surely part of the hypocrisy of Mabo, because we hear complaints about apartheid in South Africa, yet under Mabo it would be possible to work a deal whereby you would set up a sovereign and independent Aboriginal state, which of course would be apartheid. There are so many ramifications of Mabo legislation, it's difficult to cover them all. I think with reference to some of the points made by John Houston in his media release, I think some of the comments here are pretty valid, and I'll just read some of them out, and I think it's fairly consistent with what he says. The Keating legislation is rejected because it mixes Mabo with the process of reconciliation and thereby goes way beyond the High Court decision. It will be proved to be unworkable. Now, if you remember Richard, the minister in West Australia complained that it was going to be unworkable, is undoubtedly a legal, bureaucratic and administrative nightmare. Its constitutional validity will undoubtedly be questioned, especially in view of the significant grab for power by Canberra at the expense of the constitutional rights of the state for land management. Rather than reduce uncertainty, it will significantly increase it, thereby destroying investment and costing more jobs. Now, I read out the coalition suggestion here. It's a talking point. I don't know that I agree with every single point here, but there are some comments here that I think could be valid and which at least deserve consideration. The government's bill claims to recognise and protect native title when in fact the High Court has already declared its existence and has given a guarantee to Indigenous Australians that the courts will act to protect native title. The Racial Discrimination Act operates to safeguard the rights of Indigenous people and has done so in the past. With the exception of the need to validate titles, the real motive for the Keating Bill is to significantly extend Mabo and in the process to make a grab for control over the constitutional responsibility of the states for land management. Now, I think that's a key point. I think it's a valid one, to the effect that it's a power grab by Canberra in an attempt to take over state control of legislation to do with native title. In summary, he says, the problems with the Keating-Mabo Bill are many and include it is very complex. It fails to remedy the uncertainty that has arisen about land titles. It is impractical in attempting to manage state land systems. It retrospectively makes a grab for the state responsibility over native title. And this will spark a constitutional wrangle that will only cause even more uncertainty. It will unnecessarily create a new administrative, legal and bureaucratic system that will discourage investment, cost jobs and impede development. It goes way beyond the High Court's decision on Mabo, as it wrongly confuses the necessity for a legal response to Mabo with reconciliation issues. It provides for a right of negotiation which amounts to a de facto right of veto, which will impede the economic development of the land and puts at risk our biggest export earners in the mining and pastoral sectors. It proposes with little detail a hugely costly land fund. A more just and workable solution, they suggest, would include the following features: a provision that the Commonwealth states and territories may legislate to validate past grants of land titles and or prevent the invalidation of existing land titles where at the time of grant the land in question was affected, either wholly or in part by the existence of native title or by a combination of native title and the operation of any law. There should be no relaxation of the Racial Discrimination Act except to the extent that may be necessary to validate past grants, and then only on the proviso that compensation is paid on a non-discriminatory basis. Now, I won't read the full text of this, but I suggest that some of those points that have already been made are valid. They also go on, I also mentioned some other sections of it here. We will commit the Commonwealth to reimburse the states and territories for any compensation paid for the extinguishment of native title associated with the validation of past grants. State and territory laws must continue to apply to land the subject of native title. We believe that this approach will not compromise existing rights of Indigenous people, national development, jobs, the economic use of land, or the further development of Australia's mineral, pastoral or other industries. Now, Graham Campbell, MP, Federal Minister for Kalgoorlie, suggests that ATSIC should be abolished because it's a top-heavy bureaucracy which wastes a lot of money. Most of the funds given to ATSIC do not get through to the ordinary Aborigine. They feed the Aboriginal industry, but they don't do much to concern themselves with the health and well-being of the ordinary Aborigine. He suggests that compensation should be paid, and it would be cheaper and more feasible to pay compensation rather than to go through this legal wrangling that's involved now. He also suggests states' rights should be observed, that states should have much more control over native title. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If there are any questions, please let me know.